Bang on the Empire Podcast this week. Todd Phillips brings his war dogs by. Let's hope he brought a bag with him for the war poop. Plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast has just been to see the hottest musical on Broadway, Avenue Q. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, sponsored this week, very excited about this, by those high flyers at American Airlines, the world's largest airline. But they're not just sponsoring this podcast. No. They've really taken off by becoming the headline sponsor of Empire Live, our incredibly exciting entertainment extravaganza, which is coming to the O2 London from September 23rd to the 25th. And with two flights a day from Heathrow to LAX on its flagship planes, American Airlines is the preferred airline of the entertainment industry, with 260 movies, 240 TV shows available on demand, on board. That's enough content to fly around the world. I worked this out on a calculator, or an abacus, more accurately, 26 times. 26 times. So I might actually give that a go. It's probably the best chance I'll have of watching Game of Thrones.
Yeah, you should get on that.
I should get on that. So very excited to have American Airlines on board with the podcast. And incidentally, I'm just back from a thing in New York where I got to see Hamilton.
Did you?
Well, I got to see people lining up to see Hamilton. It sounded great. But I did get to see, as I said, Avenue Q.
Wow.
2004's hottest musical.
I was about to say.
With great songs like The Internet is for Porn, The Money Song, and Everyone's a Little Bit Racist. Very exciting. Anyway, this week I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen, a lady famous for her love of Hamilton, which was playing across the street from my hotel. It features such songs, of course, as The Internet is for Googling Hamilton references, the How Much Money for a Ticket song, and Everyone's Not a Little Bit Racist. It's Helen O'Hara.
That is correct. All of those pop hits, breakout hits.
Great songs. Mm. Great songs. Next up is our art house guru, whose favourite musical is, of course, the up-and-coming black-and-white subtitled one-man version of Fitzcarraldo, featuring such hits as The Internet is for Googling How to Drag a Ship Over a Mountain, The Money is a Construct of the Capitalist Masses song, and Everyone's a Little Bit Batshit Insane. It's Phil Desimlian.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. Exceptionally good, thank you.
I should have gone for Kinski Boots. Bollocks.
Oh.
This is what happens when you write the script on your way from the desk to the pod booth. Anyway, and last but not least is our very own Northern Powerhouse. A man who has no time for musicals until it is they bring out Gates, the National Treasure musical featuring such golden hits as The Declaration of Independence is for Porn, The Secret Clue is Hidden on Money song, and Everyone's a Little Bit Cagist. It's Johnny Pyle.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm good, man. You're right?
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Excellent. So, on with the podcast. It's time for this week's question, which comes from Phil.
Yes.
Who's it come from?
At Filmchild.
At Filmchild?
Yes.
Good. Thank you for having it written down.
Pleasure.
When I didn't.
Committed this to memory.
Yep.
What are your favourite movie campfire scenes?
That's amazing. Is that all it was? Or I seem to remember it being a bit more. Or
okay.
Did I just
question for my favourite podcast.
Oh,
is how it opens.
That's nice.
That implies he or she is listening to other podcasts.
Yes.
Which we don't approve of.
Yes.
At Empire Magazine, that's us. So,
okay.
Right. And
oh,
what is your favourite? That's it. There's no more question.
I thought
question.
There was a lot more than that. Okay.
No, right. There is no more question.
Favourite campfire scenes? I can't think of too many. Who wants to chip in first?
I have four.
Well, can I say one then? Because I
go
have
ahead.
One.
Okay.
And you'll probably have my one in your four.
That'll be great. Yes, please.
Okay. Stand by me.
Oh, I didn't. Well,
what?
That's good.
I should have. That's a good one.
Yeah. Elaborate.
That's
what happens,
one of
what happens in that? I can't remember.
The fat kid drops his marshmallow into the fire and because he says that's how he likes them burnt, and then it falls in the fire, and then he fishes it out and it's okay and he eats it.
That's such a great scene.
Is that when Gordy tells the story?
It's when he tells the story, yeah.
About the pie eating contest.
Oh, the pie eating contest. I've only seen that film once. Whereas Jamie Graham of Our Terrifying Foes is his favourite film of all time. He's seen it, I think, 100 times.
I have watched that like a lot of times. Mm. It's a great film.
Hi, Jamie Graham. This is the similarities between this campfire scene and the one in Easy Rider. Except
right.
There's a lot more drugs in one than the other.
You don't know what's in those marshmallows. Think of a Hangover too.
Yeah, exactly. I think that this has all the hallmarks of these kids growing up to be those characters because they're doing exactly the same stuff, just shooting, just talking absolute stone nonsense around the campfire.
Jack Nicholson.
No, yeah, well, no, yeah. Yes, but I mean, in Stand By Me, they have this whole...
No,
kind
obviously
of like,
not Jack Nicholson Stand By Me. I've only seen it once.
Yeah,
but,
Jack Nicholson.
Does the timeline work?
For
when is Stand By Me set?
It's probably a set.
No.
No, it's not quite
it's
right.
It's about the same time.
No, no, the, no I think Stand By Me is earlier. The 50s.
Oh, yeah, right.
So it's not impossible, but they'd...
I mean,
like if it's
the same characters,
but if it was the same characters, an Easy Rider as Stand By Me, like they've done some hard living in between,
hard living.
Which they have.
Although in fairness, Jack Nicholson's character is a lawyer, right? He's a civil rights lawyer,
yeah,
and a bit of an alky, obviously as well.
Sure.
And he.
So you think Chris? You think he's Chris? You think he's River Phoenix?
I don't know.
You think River Phoenix?
I feel like we're wading
like
into
murky
we'll never know.
Territory.
Oh,
it's hard to say. It's a good theory, though. Good theory.
That's really dark, Johnny.
But it is. They do have this kind of this riff about Goofy. Doesn't he say is Mickey's a mouse, Donald's a duck, Pluto's a dog? What's Goofy?
Yeah, nobody knows what Goofy is.
No, but that keeps they keep coming back, and then he's a dog. No, he's not a dog.
Mm. No, he's just something else.
Well, I can
man.
Tell them that he is a dog.
He is a dog.
Officially, is a dog. Yeah, his original character name. I've looked this up. Was Dippy Dog.
But he does look like a dog.
He's a dog. He doesn't.
Yeah, but the problem
like
is that he is a dog who walks and talks, and Pluto is a dog who's a dog.
Yeah. So why is Pluto a dog who's a dog when Goofy's a dog who isn't?
Ducks don't walk and talk either, and yet we accept that.
Are there ducks? Are there actual ducks in that universe as well?
That's the difference, isn't it? Well, like there's a doggy dog, but also a non-doggy dog. So that's the point where
and there's a Snoop doggy dog,
makes no sense, obviously. Or he might be a lion. It's hard to tell.
I'm really confused. I've got a supplementary question. Is Stand By Me the best film named after an Oasis song?
It wasn't.
I really like Live Forever, which is a documentary.
I really like Supersonic,
yeah,
which
Supersonic's
is an Oasis
pretty good,
documentary.
Yeah.
And how does Stephen King know that Oasis would name a song Stand By Me?
Yeah, you don't think maybe it was named after the Benny King song? Because I think it's definitely the best song, best film named after a Ben E. King song.
The what?
Ben... Middle initial E, surname King.
No. No.
The song Stand
No,
By Me.
Helen.
It plays over the credits.
No,
first.
Helen.
It's a clue.
He's an Oasis fan.
Okay. I have several I'd like to add.
It's interesting. You said four. You've got four.
Yeah.
That's now changed to several.
And yeah,
before,
it's four.
Here, I'm going to pull the curtain back a little bit. Before we started recording this podcast, you said you had two. So
no, I
I'm
said
gonna,
I had
what's
three,
your
and I remembered
three?
Another one.
Three? Now you change. Your story is changing. I'm sorry. As a ex-barrister... That's a disgrace.
You're allowed to bring in new evidence before you present it.
Oh, my God.
You can't change your plea.
Objection!
Overruled.
That's not a thing.
Oh, okay.
All of you are ridiculous. Okay. First of all, one you're not going to particularly argue with or discuss because none of you feel very strongly about the film, I suspect. Pitch Perfect 2. They have a come-to-Jesus moment around the campfire, as Anna Kendrick described it, and that's when they rediscover their mojo and their love of singing together.
I have hugely strong feelings about that film.
Do you?
Yeah.
What are they?
Because I love the first one and did not love the second one anywhere near as much.
I'm sorry to hear that. Second of all, Hunt for the Wilder People, it's not much in the way of a campfire scene, but there is a campfire in it. It's one of my favourite films, so I'm just going to mention it here and leave it at that. Mm-hmm. Now, two that you're actually going to chime with. Which one shall I go with first? Three Amigos. Three Amigos, they sing around a campfire and it is delightful.
Are you going to play it now and stop
I actually
the whole
know
podcast
the song.
And its tracks? Go on then. It's by Randy Newman, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? I'm trying to remember the first word, though. Is it California Moon? Basically,
Was it Moon Shadows?
Yeah, it's Blue Shadows on the Plain. Soft wind blowing through the trees above.
I don't like this bit.
What? That's experimental.
Anyway,
we may cut that
it's actually
out.
A really nice song.
I like
it's,
that. Helen, what a lovely singing voice.
Thank you very
the
much.
Horse, yeah. The horse.
That was Helen
singing.
The horse.
Horse. The horses. Yeah. And there's some sort of... I don't remember, there's some sort of tortoise behind Chevy Chase on the rock.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
just
all
sort of
the animals.
And the owls getting in this
it's
good
It's very
good
Disney.
Stuff.
But the one you're all forgetting and the one you're all going to kick yourselves for forgetting is Blazing Saddles.
Except... Well, it's on my list.
Except we didn't forget it.
I haven't got there yet.
Well, I don't know. You hadn't said it.
You spoke first. Doesn't mean that we forgot it.
I didn't speak first. I was
God,
like... You're
what
the
kind of a lawyer
you're the worst
are you?
Barrister in the world. I was fourth.
You should quit. You should quit
it.
As a barrister.
You all forgot
You
it.
Should stop being a barrister right now.
Well, I will.
Okay, then. I've won the case. Court adjourned. Blazing Saddles. Why, Helen?
Oh, wow, Chris. That's a great suggestion.
# fart rump.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the campfire you'd most want to be around, is it, actually?
I think so.
They've got
awesome.
Food.
Yeah. I mean, it's high in fibre.
think of the methane. Just think of the methane. That'd be amazing. That's a great scene. Very, very funny scene. Phil Cat.
Yes.
What have you got?
I've also got... we talked about Blazing Saddles. No. We talked about Easy Rider.
Yes,
but we didn't really talk about Easy Rider. Jack Nicholson's character, the aforementioned lawyer, falls in, obviously, with Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper. And they introduce him to marijuana, I think is how it's pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, he's all kind of like, no, I can't do this. I've already got a drinking problem. I can't really also have a, you know, I'll get into harder stuff immediately. And then eventually they persuade him to. And then within seconds, he's talking about alien conspiracies. It's like, I think he's got previous experience in this area.
Seems likely.
He's straight into it. That goes on for ages, and I'm not sure it's a particularly hot favourite of mine, looking back. Film seems to have dated quite a lot, to put it mildly.
Right. I feel like we're missing a lot of Westerns, apart from Blazing Saddles.
Yes. We undoubtedly are.
Okay.
Almost.
I'm all right with
that. I think every Western contractually has to have a campfire scene of someone... They sit around a campfire and they talk about the campfire.
Yeah.
And they eat things from the campfire.
Wow, this is blowing it all wide open.
That great film.
Or how about when Sam is cooking in Lord of the Rings, I think it's Return of the King.
I thought you were going to mention Supernatural.
I wasn't. No, Sam Gamgee cooking around the campfire. He gets a bit of rabbit and some taters.
Isn't there a campfire scene in The Attack of the Clones? I'm sure there's a campfire scene in Attack of the Clones. I think that's why I gave a 5. I think that's it. Yeah.
What with Anakin and Padme
I'm pretty sure they're in the meadow or something.
They're in
Tatooine and he's having a strop about something. And
isn't he killing all the sand people on this campfire's there? He ruins a lovely campfire.
That's it.
But they haven't nicked his mum.
Yeah. He goes apeshit on the Tusken Raiders. I mean, which. Perfectly understandable. They're absolute dicks.
I can't help thinking there's one in Red River that's quite an important plot point, but I can't give you any of the details.
Oh, I can't remember.
Well, City Slickers that's an important one because that's when they start to bond over a harmonica. Maybe don't play it, do play it. They sing.
Yeah, but all of those ones, like the ones that we mentioned, Three Amigos, Blazing Saddles, City Slickers, they're all kind of riffs on the Western campfire scene, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
So logically, we should have more of those than we do of the riffs on. But
yeah,
we
shows our age.
We haven't
because they're probably because they're so ubiquitous.
Yeah,
because they're just part of the furniture of a Western.
Yeah,
whereas they become the sort of comic centerpiece of a
non-Western.
Homage non-Western. Yeah. I guess in the Western also they always have the trackers.
Mm-hmm.
They're always kind of like trying to find the people, and they've always just left the fire.
Yes,
and it's still smouldering.
Yes,
it's like hide it.
Just
cover it up.
Just throw some rocks on it, dude. Like
fire thing. Just
oh no! If you put water on it, you see that makes more smoke. I've seen that in a few films.
Have we?
Yeah. If you pour water over the campfire to put it out, then there's like a big plume of smoke. So then the people tracking you definitely find you. So you need to kick earth over it,
like an Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
Where they're tracking them.
There's a good campfire scene coming up in a few weeks, as well as Wilder People. There's also one in American Honey, which is very good. So look out for that. In September, October.
I'm obviously going to mention a couple of horror films. In fact, first of all, I'm going to mention the most horrific film of them all, Police Academy. There is a big campfire scene in that, in which it's a lot of female nudity, which...
Police Academy?
When I saw it as a child, was very interesting. And it was like... And Tackleberry in that scene, if you remember Tackleberry, all of the ladies start taking their tops off, and Tackleberry has a bit of gog. He's like, "What's happening here?" So that's a good scene. And then there's obviously campfires lend themselves very well to horror films as well. You know, people sit around a campfire in real life and they tell scary, spooky stories. And then things creep up on them and stuff. So, yeah, very, very obviously, I'm going to mention The Beginning of the Fog, where Mr. Macon, I've mentioned this in the podcast before. I think it was even on Beach Scenes a couple of weeks ago. So there it is. But that one, where Mr. Macon, played by John Houseman, basically recounts the prequel story of The Fog and sets up the movie. And that was added quite late in production, I believe. And then yesterday I was rewatching The Burning, which is a really weird 1981 slasher movie. Came along post Halloween, post Friday the 13th, one of that kind of crop of cash-ins, of rip-offs. But it's a really weird film. It's got lots of markers, really interesting markers. It's got a score by Rick Wakeman. It was co-written by Bob Weinstein. It's the first Miramax film. So it was produced by Harvey Weinstein. In fact, it came from his idea as well. It's amongst the cast is young Jason Alexander with a full head of hair and a young Holly Hunter, also, weirdly, with a full head of hair, which is...
Madness.
Yeah, madness. And Thomas Feeney did the special effects, some really, really gory special effects. There are two pivotal scenes around a campfire. One, where the hero of the film, who is directly responsible for the burning of the title, which leads to the disfigurement of a guy called Cropsey, who becomes the mad killer who tracks down the teens at a summer camp.
So he's the Bryce Dallas Howard in Jurassic World of this whole thing.
Well, yeah, but he recounts the story of how Cropsey became disfigured to the kids, but as a scary campfire story, neglecting to mention his parts, his involvement in it. So basically, yeah, me and my friends, we accidentally burnt this guy alive. It was a bit of a prank. Anyway, we covered it up. I became a camp counselor, and ooh, Cropsey might get you. Forgets to mention that at any point.
That's kind of
weird. So there you go, the burning.
Something about campfires and beaches has just reminded me of the worst campfire scene in history, which is in a terrible film called The Covenant, which is kind of like The Craft, but for boys.
Boys suck.
Anyway, and they have this just really ham-fisted exposition scene where they explain who these guys are, and it's honestly got some of the worst dialogue I've ever heard. They call themselves like it's something, I can't remember the name of the time, but it's something like the Sons of Eastwick, and everyone refers to these four boys in this scene as the Sons of Eastwick. Like, that is a thing that anyone in the modern age would say about anyone. It's the worst thing I've ever heard. So yeah, that's what you want to avoid.
That's what you want to avoid.
I got one more. Big fan of The Straight Story. Quite an un-Lynchy David Lynch movie, but it's got a lovely campfire scene. Richard Farnsworth's character, as you may remember, is driving across the Midwest on a lawnmower, one of the early plot lines, one of the early Fast and Furious movies that was discarded. And he picks up a young girl who's basically run away from home and sits her down next to the campfire. They have a chat around the campfire that night, and he demonstrates using sticks that he's tied together how your family is stronger than the individual person within it. And in the morning he wakes up and she's gone, but she's left him a bundle of sticks, which sort of implies that she's taken his wisdom on board and gone back and made amends with her family, which is kind of nice.
That's lovely. Or she just left some sticks behind.
Or she's part of the Blair Witch Project.
Can I just say that I thought that your joke about the Fast and Furious was far better than the silence it received in the room.
It wasn't that.
I thought it deserved a mild titter.
What was it? I didn't hear it.
You what?
He was talking directly and looking directly at you.
Yeah, but I've got many
things on his mind.
What was it? What was it?
I said that.
I don't want to listen to the podcast.
Never mind.
To hear it.
The guys don't need to hear this in the editing. I'll tell you afterwards.
Okay.
But thanks, Johnny. I really appreciate that. What we should do is email each other if we find things funny afterwards.
All right, let's do that. Let's do that.
Anyway,
readers, so if you thought that Phil's Fast and Furious joke was funny, which I'm sure it was,
we'll do a poll.
Then write in, and also write in as well with all the campfire scenes we've missed, because I'm sure there are dozens, as Phil and Helen mentioned, the classic westerns a go-go. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, and why the hell wouldn't you, send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us, of course, at podcast@empireonline.com. Right, we're going to have a quick trawl through the week's movie news, because we don't have a lot of time left. So, what's the haps? What's been the haps?
You did an amusing tweet about Doug Liman.
I did, didn't I?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes, nailed it.
I tried to tell someone about it last night, but I got it completely wrong and it sounded really bad.
Is it? Okay. So, well,
or
listen,
maybe I got it completely right.
I loved your Fast and Furious joke.
You weren't listening, but yes, thanks.
I can't listen to everything, Phil.
You can't listen to everything I say.
What did he say?
I can't remember. Okay. It was a good one, though. Yeah. Why don't you paraphrase the tweet? I know we don't like you to retweet yourself verbally, but do it in this case, and then you can tell the story of what the story.
Well, of course, now you can retweet yourself.
Yeah, but not verbally.
No, not verbally. That's weird. Yeah, okay. But you know, it's a nebulous thing, isn't it? Comedy. So Doug Liman has signed up this week. He's left Gambit, the long gestating Channing Tatum man throws a pack of playing cards at people superhero movie over at Fox. I wonder that, you know, that's been rumored for a while to have script issues, and he's not the first director to leave the project, and so he has gone from that into another comic book movie. He has joined the DC Extended Universe, the DCEU, where he would direct Justice League Dark, which is a sort of spookier version of the Justice League, bringing together characters like John Constantine. Okay, so that's the setup, and now the joke. I'm not surprised that Doug Liman is directing a comic book movie, because superheroes have always been his destiny ever since he was bitten by a radioactive lime.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Is it too late to unretweet that?
I can't drop the mic.
No, don't drop the mic. It's very fragile.
I'm going to place it gently on its side.
No, don't. Well, but how are we going to get your voice?
What?
No, we can't hear you.
They can hear me perfectly.
They really can't. You're very muffled.
Well, make sure you make an effort to listen.
You don't.
Like you did to Phil.
I have learned a valuable lesson today. I only listen to 3% of what Phil says, but the 3% I hear is
that's
great.
Enough. I reckon the perfect person to come in and rescue the franchise, the DCEU now, is the man who made Swingers. He can bring some humour into the situation. I don't know.
Yes. I'm not really sure. Edge of Tomorrow was fantastic. He started a pretty damn good franchise with Jason Bourne.
Right.
Bourne Identity.
I think he's underrated, Doug Liman. I think...
Liman.
Lime man.
Yeah, I'm saying Lehman because it means you can't do that joke anymore. Lyman.
No, you can't change a man's surname just because of the joke.
The joke was probably bad.
It was pretty bad.
It was a fucking great joke. Up yours.
Okay.
Unbelievable. Do you know how many retweets I got? 7. Okay. So if I'd been at a comedy club, that means 7 people would have laughed and it got like 20 likes, something like that. So 20 people would have chuckled and maybe nudged their friends and gone, "That's all right." Okay.
I think it works better written down.
Yeah,
probably
agree.
Does. So, Justice League Dark.
Yes.
How dark is it going to be? Dark is dark.
Yeah, as someone said, finally, some darkness brought to the DCEU. Which is funnier than my tweet. But yeah, I'm intrigued by this. Doug Liman is obviously someone who flits around from project to project. He's already made 2 films. He's got 2 films. There's a film he made for Amazon, which is coming out, I think, next year. And he made American Made with Tom Cruise, which was formerly known as Mina. And that's sitting and waiting to be released as well. So he's very busy, very prolific. But he's a flitter. You get the sense that he's got loads of projects on the go, including, Phil, as you know, a remake of Escape to Victory, which is something he's got on the back burner. So it'll be interesting to see whether he follows through with this and actually makes Justice League Dark, which began as a Guillermo del Toro project, one of the 475, talking to people who flit around, 475 projects that Guillermo was trying to make. So I don't know, it's intriguing. You know, and
what does it mean for Gambit?
Gambit's interesting, and I was going to say that post X-Men Apocalypse, which didn't really get a great reaction critically or indeed at the box office, certainly compared to Deadpool and Days of Future Past, I kind of wondered whether it's been a lot of silence from Fox on the old X-Men universe thing, and I wondered if they were having a major rethink. And then today it was revealed that Josh Boone, who's directing New Mutants, has brought on his Fault in Our Stars writers to help him hone that script. But I thought that script was nearly ready to go. I thought that one was virtually the next on the production line. So you do wonder if there's a lot of recalibration and rethinking going on over there at Fox.
I mean, maybe it'll free things up. Maybe there's less pressure to tie these things together now, and just, you know, more thinking about how can we tell good individual stories. So it could end up for the best, you know. Fingers crossed.
But yeah, again, it speaks to, I think, DC's, because they have to compete with Marvel, don't they? They have, you know, they've got to, you know, bring new things to the table. And going after, I think, A-list talent is clearly something that they're doing, for the most part anyway. And Doug Liman is an A-list director.
Yeah.
I think. And he's a really interesting director. I love Edge of Tomorrow. I think that film is fantastic.
It's a good movie. Can we skip from the DCEU to the... RDCU, the Roald Dahl Cinematic Universe, and news that Sam Mendes is potentially going to be making a live-action version of James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah, I'm excited by this.
A film that was, of course, made by the great Henry Selick in 1996 as a stop-motion animation will now be live-action, which presents some obvious questions about where on earth you source a peach that large.
I mean, I think it'll be live action in the same way that The Jungle Book was live action, which is to say about 5% live action or maybe a little less.
The term live action seems so fluid these days.
Well, I mean, it is actually genuinely, I mean, it's a question we've sometimes talked about in the office, but the definition of an animated film, I mean, is Avatar an animated film? Because most of it is animated. Gravity, about the only thing that isn't animated, is Sandra Bullock's face. And even that is sometimes animated. I'm not
that's
kidding.
Not nice.
I'm not crushing criticism of Sandy Bullock.
She's not animated in the sense that she is not actually a product of animation.
Well,
She is animated in the sense of having emotion.
Objection, Your Honour.
George Clooney was completely animated in that movie.
George Clooney... No, but George Clooney's face was real and everything else is... And even the... He's got a plate in front of his face. That is also animated. It was not actually there. They were not wearing spacesuits. Wake up, sheeple.
I'm getting pretty animated right now, I'll tell you that much.
Oh my God.
I'm not slagging off Gravity. It's a film that I'm on record as loving.
You are slagging it off.
I'm not slagging it off. I'm paying tribute to the VFX artists who worked on it. My point is...
Helen hates almost... Gravity. Hashtag Helen hates Gravity.
Yes, that's right. I want to float away.
Why do you hate being tethered to the ground, Helen?
If you would ever let me finish a sentence, what I'm saying is... The definition of what constitutes live action or animation is... increasingly suspect.
You're a communist.
Yes.
What's going on?
Yeah, well, in fairness, Helen's absolutely spot on and right. It's probably not going to be a giant peach because that's impossible. But it is going to be that model. And I think The Jungle Book has raised the bar for that sort of Disney-style family adventure-y type thing. What I love about the Roald Dahl sort of source material is he seems so elastic to so many different sorts of directors. You know, Spielberg obviously with BFG this year, but you know, Nick Rogue made Witches, which is I think one of the best Dahl adaptations. Fantastic Mr. Fox, Wes Anderson. I mean, you know, he's able to take lots of different styles and his stories are very...
My only concern about the James and the Giant Peach in particular, as opposed to a lot of the others, if you do it live action and you want to make these things look realistic, you have to make a spider and a cricket and all of these bugs look realistic, but also not horrific when the size of a boy.
Yes.
That's going to be maybe a little bit of a challenge.
You wouldn't want to be too much like Pan's Labyrinth, for instance.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of that scene in King Kong that made me scream and cover my eyes quite a lot with the giant insect. Oh. Giant insects are not inherently cute, so I'll be interested to see how they get around that design problem.
I suppose you could tweak the magic to make them cuter. That's what they do. So like suddenly they stand on two legs.
I'm sure they'll do that kind of thing, but that isn't necessarily cute if you're then seeing the front of the underside of a ladybird. If she's standing up on two legs, like the underside
exposing herself.
No, but it's an unpleasant thing to look at. I'm just thinking
for you, maybe.
All right, you know what? Fine.
My main concern is that so often on screen, people claim they're like eating a peach or holding a peach, and it's a nectarine. And
it's upsetting.
I mean, if it's a giant nectarine floating across the sky, then
you're not interested.
I'm going to be utterly fuming for the 80 minutes of screen time that
it gets. I trust in Sam Mendes to get that detail right. I would hope so.
Can we check? Should we go into his office?
Well, he's just down the road, so let's just go and buzz the intercom at lunchtime.
Sam in!
No.
We'd like to see his peach, please.
I beg your pardon. I've told you before. Go away!
Day 76 the shoot. Shit, it's a plum. but I would want to stress... That he is yet to commit 100% to this, so don't go and buzz him yet. But Nick Hornby has got the script together.
Okay.
My from Skyfall to Groundfall pun is on ice, ready to go. So let's just...
I heard that one.
You see where I'm coming from there?
That's
is Groundfall even a thing? Have I made that up? Is that something that...
Sounds like something. Right?
Anyway.
There's a different word, isn't there? What's the word? You know, apples that fall from the tree.
Gravity.
I hate gravity.
Hashtag Helen hates gravity. Right, so let's talk about something that happened last week after the podcast went live, which is this whole nonsense about that escalated when people got furious, racists got furious because Zendaya is going to play Mary Jane Watson in Spider-Man Homecoming.
So it seems.
Anyway, it seems that way.
Yeah, very much.
Fairly 93% rumour.
Yeah.
And... lots of people got up in arms about this, revealing their true colours. And even though, Helen, everyone's a little bit racist,
yes,
they're idiots.
Yes, they are. Honestly, I mean, how could you get better casting than her for a character who's meant to be a sort of model/actress? You know,
because she's a
model/actress, and she's good in her Disney show work.
Is she?
I believe I haven't seen much of it. Yeah. I'll be honest, but what I've seen has been perfectly fine. It's really interesting because I've seen people who clearly, you know, consider themselves good people and everything, but they have concerns that, and they say things like, well, as long as she has the talent, I guess that'll be okay. It's like, do you say that about a white actress? as long as she has the talent, that will be okay. Of course, I mean, that's an obvious thing, isn't it? But you don't need to say it usually because you just assume, hey, she's got red hair, she must have the talent. It just, it doesn't follow.
So in case you don't know, in case you don't read the comics or didn't see any of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies, Mary Jane Watson is probably the great love of Peter Parker's life, along with Gwen Stacy, Squash. Not squashed, but you know.
Too soon.
Too soon. R.I.P. Gwen. And, you know, she becomes his wife. Blah, blah, blah. And she, in the comic books and in the movies, played by Kirsten Dunst, she's white with red hair. And people were up, some people, not everyone obviously, were up in arms about the fact that she wouldn't be played by an African-American woman. And so?
So?
I mean, I think it's
Zendaya
really interesting.
Actually, the cast also looks really good with red hair. She's had red hair in the past.
But the cast of Homecoming is refreshingly multicultural. And if they want to reflect what I imagine, having not gone to high school in New York in the mid-2000s and 10s.
Good.
I imagine, yes. That's not why I was in New York this week. I imagine that it reflects the makeup of a New York school in this day and age.
Yes, correct. You're not going to find a majority white school, I guess, in Queens.
Do you have strong feelings about this one, Johnny?
Or do I have strong? Well, am I one of those racists online who's been complaining about it?
I guess that's a subtext of what I'm asking. I'm not.
That
I'm
was,
not,
that was not, not me. Not.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm sure we're on the same page here. But I think that I don't remember us having these conversations. We've been doing this podcast for a while. I don't remember having these conversations a couple of years ago. It seems to come every week now, you know, whether it's Ghostbusters or this or Oceans, the Oceans movie. It's just like,
what's
will
happened?
You just shut up.
I know.
People well, the fact that we're having those conversations means that Hollywood is doing something right.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Because the conversations we used to have about casting were about whether someone was just suited to the role and in terms of, you know, that isn't Jack Reacher or whoever. But now it's, you know, their conversations about you can't cast a woman. Well, yes, you can. You can cast a woman in that role. Of course you can. So the fact that Hollywood is trying to be more progressive, I think, can only be a good thing, and these conversations will happen. But, you know, we have to fight the good fight.
Yeah, and by the way, much love this week to Leslie Jones, who suffered another horrific attack from the absolute monsters who've been after her online for existing.
Oh, amen to that. And I think Johnny makes a really interesting point there. But I think Hollywood's sort of been through this. You know, Sidney Poitier broke down quite a lot of these barriers back in the day. You know, in films like The Defiant Ones.
Yeah.
Looking back, you're like, wow, that was really out there for that time. Probably still now, actually, which is a bit depressing. But maybe you're right. Maybe they're making progress. Maybe that's what we're hearing.
I just want to wrap up a couple of news stories during the week. Disney's making a Nutcracker movie. They've already apparently got Keira Knightley in their sights as the Sugar Plum Fairy with the American Ballet Company's Misty Copeland as the actual ballerina bits. Mackenzie Foy would be playing the little girl Clara. Morgan Freeman is lined up for Drosselmeyer. And they're now talking Helen Mirren as Mother Ginger. So that's actually shaping up to be a very, very good cast. I mean,
honestly didn't understand any word you said there apart from Helen Mirren, Morgan Freeman, Keira Knightley. And
okay, it's a ballet. It's a very famous ballet. It's set at Christmas. Little girl gets a nutcracker. Her brother breaks it. She goes downstairs at night and all these other things come to life and she goes on a magical adventure. It's kind of The Snowman, but with toys.
Gotcha.
It's one of these things, if you get it right, it becomes a perennial Christmas movie and you hear about it and you get money every year forever.
And if you get it wrong, everyone dies.
And it doesn't matter because the cast got the money anyway. So it's fine.
Captain Marvel, they've got a director's shortlist now. Nikki Caro, who's been rumoured for ages, the director of Whale Rider, is on it. Leslie Linka Glatter, who's mostly a TV director, but she's worked on the likes of The Walking Dead and Homeland, so she's obviously got it where it counts. And Lorraine Scafaria, who directed Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, speaking of Keira Knightley, are apparently the shortlist, so we're probably looking at one of them to work with.
So Brie Larson. Clearly pursuing a female director to direct their first major female superhero.
Oh, really? Are they all women? I guess so. And finally, just very quickly wrapping up, there was a huge hit last year or a couple of years ago, French film called Intouchables, Untouchables. Ooh. Thank you. And they are now inevitably remaking it in Hollywood. It was about
you send one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue.
The other Untouchables. No, this was about
take it easy. Why do you think I sent the book home in the first place?
Okay, it's actually about a wealthy paraplegic, quadriplegic, I should say, who hires a young black man as his caretaker. Caregiver, I guess, would be the Best word. Anyway, Neil Berger's directing. The casting apparently now lined up is Bryan Cranston as the wealthy man, and then Kevin Hart as his caregiver. That role was originally played by
Omar.
Omar Sy. So yeah, he's definitely shorter.
Okay.
So there you go.
Yes. All right. Excellent. I will mark my calendar accordingly.
It's a good film, Chris.
Yes.
You like Bryan Cranston?
I love Bryan Cranston.
He's a charismatic man.
He is. So, and also this week,
some Fraserhead news.
I'm afraid so.
Oh no! What's happened?
Michael Leader has sadly passed away. You may not recognise his name. But he played the milkman on EastEnders since 1985. But he will go down in cinematic history as the stormtrooper who banged his head on the door of the Death Star.
Aww.
in Star Wars, the original Star Wars, in 1977. He passed away on Monday, which is very, very sad.
That is very sad news indeed. But there is some good news on the horizon, because this week is New Empire Week.
Woo.
The new issue of Empire is now on sale. It is a cracking issue. Rogue One, Star Wars Rogue One, is on the cover. We had incredible access to that movie. Gareth Edwards spilling the beans left, right and centre on that film to Dan Jolin. That heads up our incredible, or as the French say, incredible, autumn winter preview. 21 huge films and TV shows coming your way in the next few months. All sorts of great things. What's quickly, Helen, what's in there?
We've got American Gods in
there. That's in there.
We've got American Pastoral.
That's in there.
American Honey.
That's in there.
They're all in there. No, it's a great feature section. We got some really exciting people to talk about what they're doing next. Tom Ford is in there if you're feeling stylish.
Uh-uh.
Talk about his next film, Nocturnal Animals. We've got Doctor Strange. We've got all sorts of goodies in there. La La Land, A Monster Calls, gorgeous picture from that. Assassin's Creed, Passengers, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Jack Reacher. It's all going on.
It's all kicking off. Plus, the director of The Greasy Strangler, which is a film that you have to see. I mean, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. But my God, it's fucked up beyond belief. Do go and see it when it comes out. We got the director,
if
Jim Hoskin.
Ready. Mm-hmm.
If you like Grease and Stranglings, then this movie is for you. And just so happened. Anyway, Jim Hoskin wrote a really funny piece for us about the movie, which is one of the year's weirdest movies.
Yes.
I'm not saying it's the year's weirdest movie, because Sausage Party and Swiss Army Man also came out this year, and they're plenty weird too.
It's a pretty weird feature.
It's a very weird feature. Yeah, he goes into detail about prosthetic penises and Grease, and
yes.
You know, but it is eye-opening and it really lifts the curtain. So,
so to speak. Plus, also in the feature section, very, very quickly, Oliver Stone. We talked to a lot of people who worked with him over the years. Tim Burton talking about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
That's a gorgeous feature.
Sam Neill is the Empire interview.
Can I just say, this is my favourite feature in the magazine. I know one's not supposed to have favourites, but the Sam Neill piece.
They're not children, they're just features.
Oh, in that case, Sam Neill is totally my favourite. First of all, it has an extremely dishy picture of him. Yeah. And second of all, he's extremely funny. When we're told that, you know, 1 in 9 people in New Zealand have seen Hunt for the Wilder People, he says, which begs the question, what's wrong with the other 8? So,
there you go.
Quite right.
Plus, we have a feature on the Ron Howard and the Beatles, where Dorian Lynskey got to meet the Beatles.
At least you're not jealous, though, Chris. We couldn't send you. You were somewhere else that week. Jesus, Chris, there's actual smoke coming out of your ears.
I'm not jealous. Well, to be fair, you only got to meet 2 of the Beatles.
And the dead ones at that.
Yeah. In preview this month, there's all sorts of great stuff. There's a Lego Batman preview, Westworld preview, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 preview, first look at Free Fire, Ben Wheatley's new movie, which is very, very exciting. In the review section, the Russos and the writers of Captain America Civil War take us through that movie. Patrick Stewart talks about Green Room. There's a Star Trek the Animated Series piece, and there's a piece on The Commitments as well with Alan Parker. Thank you, Phil. It's very exciting. And in on-screen Johnny's section, it's all kicking off. There's all sorts of things being reviewed that are coming out your way. It's amazing. £4.50. Is it £4.50?
Yeah.
£4.50.
It's £4.50.
In All Good and Evil newsagents. That's amazing.
Ouch.
Time now for a guest. He is a man that Empire magazine once described as the funniest man in America. He is a director of such films as The Hangover, The Hangover Part 2, The Hangover Part 3, Old School and Road Trip. He is, of course, Todd Phillips, who breaks out into slightly more serious territory this week with War Dogs. A tale stars Jonah Hill and Miles Teller about two illicit and slightly incompetent gunrunners. Todd Phillips came into London recently. He spoke to our very own Dario Nugento, John Nugent. Enjoy the interview.
Todd Phillips, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
Great, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for being with us. We are obviously here to talk about War Dogs. When people see that this is a film directed by the guy who did The Hangover, they might expect a certain kind of movie. They might expect something along the lines of Ken Jeong jumping naked out of a car, you know, and it's not really that sort of movie.
No, it's not.
Was there a big sort of change in approach to your directing this time?
Not really, you know, because ultimately the Hangover movies and movies I've made even before that are about guys who make bad decisions.
Right.
And the bad decisions lead to mayhem and chaos. And this is sort of in the same vein, the big difference being that this is sort of a comedic drama as opposed to an outright comedy. But ultimately, it's in the same world. It's not as big a step as you might think. I'm not saying it's The Hangover. I don't want people to expect The Hangover. But it exists in the same world, so to speak. And it feels to me like you can feel it's the same director.
Yeah. I've noticed there's a sort of mini trend at the moment of comedy directors moving towards more like serious material, like Adam McKay and
Yeah, he did a great
Jay
job
Roach.
With that movie. Right,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, do you share notes with these guys? Is this?
I mean, I know them both pretty well, and I love them both. It wasn't so much a conscious decision. I mean, Adam had been working on The Big Short for a couple of years. We've been working on this since 2011.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, oh, let me see what everybody's doing. Yeah. And I think same for him. It's just really with the material that, quote unquote, turns you on, you know. And yeah. I read this story first in Rolling Stone magazine, and I had the reaction that most people would have, which is, I can't believe this shit happened, you know.
Right.
And the more we looked into it and the more we unwound it and unpacked the story, the more it just kept feeling like a movie, you know.
So how much is sort of closely skewed to real life? I know there's scenes like he impersonates military officers, Jonah Hill's character.
Yeah.
And pretends to be like a grieving parent and stuff.
Right.
That actually happened.
Well, you know, it's not a documentary, I'll tell you that much. So we basically took an article that was 5 pages long and wrote a movie about it, you know. So you can imagine we made up a lot of things. And one of the, you know, liberating things about making a movie where we're not making Lincoln, we're not making the Muhammad Ali story where everybody knows Muhammad Ali, what he looks like, what he sounds like. We're making a movie about two anonymous guys from Miami Beach. So we definitely took liberties with the characters. You know, Jonah colored his character in ways that are very different than the real Ephraim, I'm sure. But I think that as long as the gist of what the movie is, you know, the gist of the story comes across, which it does, I think, you know, that's what's important.
Yeah. And these guys, I mean, these guys are obviously the characters they play are bad guys. I mean, they're you know, they're ambiguous.
I mean, I don't think they're bad guys.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they're great guys.
But they're...
I think they're just guys who look for an angle and look for a loophole, which a lot of young people and a lot of old people do all the time.
Yeah.
I think ultimately, if you watch the movie through the correct lens, you realize the movie's actually an indictment of the government and the Pentagon's process of or ability to look the other way, then it is really an indictment on these two guys. I mean, you know, one friend does cross the other friend, and that's not so cool, but I kind of think it's that these two guys are awesome in the end.
Interesting. I hope it's not too much of a spoiler to say Bradley Cooper is in this movie.
No,
and
he's
brilliant in it.
Yeah, Bradley walks in and just kills everything always. Yeah. You know, he's just so solid.
I really wanted to ask about his glasses, because, I mean, you have the world's most handsome man in your movie, and you make him look quite unpleasant. Like, he looks
like
a serial killer.
Well, it's very funny you say that, because I remember the night I found a picture and I emailed it to Bradley, and the picture was of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Okay.
And I said, these are the glasses Henry's his character that Henry needs to wear. And Bradley emailed me right back, and he's like, I love it. But I found those glasses literally on the internet looking at a picture of Jeffrey Dahmer, because I had in my head the idea that he wears these really thick glasses.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to speak to the real life characters in the movie.
Yeah, we worked with the real life David Packhouse, who Miles Teller plays in the movie. Mm. We didn't speak to the real life Ephraim. When we were writing the movie, Ephraim was still in jail. In fact, when we were making the movie, he was still in jail. And he didn't want to partake in the movie. He's writing his own book and telling his own story.
So you don't know his reaction to...
No, I don't think he's seen the movie yet. It's not out yet in the States, so okay. I don't know that he's probably hasn't seen it yet.
But is David sort of broadly in support of it?
Oh, yeah, David loved it. Yeah. David saw it, loved it, felt it was pretty accurate okay. and all those things, yeah.
Interesting. What about the arms industry as a whole? Have you had any... Did you speak to anyone in that world?
Yeah, I mean, through research, we talked to a lot of people yeah. that are in that world. We went to a few arms conventions and met with some of those people. And again, you know, the thing you realize is that it's a business to most of these people, and it's they could right. be selling pianos if it was the government wanted pianos, you know. So yeah. it just felt very much like another business, except one where there is a huge amount of money to both spend and be made.
And this is it's obviously a very international movie. I mean, you're all over the place. Was there any location that gave you a bit of trouble? Was like Morocco?
No, you know, we shot this movie in Jordan, Morocco, Romania. We shot in Miami, Las Vegas, El Centro. Yeah. We were all over the world. And for me, none of them gave us any trouble. They were all wonderful. And really, the reason for that is I love chaos in movies, especially when the movies are supposed to be chaotic. And I feel like when you travel with a cast and crew, a lot of people, and you're flying to all these countries and everybody's jet lagged and doesn't know where the hell they are, there's a chaos on set that always finds its way into the film, and I think it's really additive and kind of hard to act or pretend or portray, but it just always ends up in there.
Right.
You know?
Were there any moments where it felt a bit out of hand? Like, was there anything?
I mean, on the streets of Morocco, I think we were shooting in Casablanca one day, and it's hard to lock down a street in Morocco. Oh, they don't sure. give a shit about orange cones, you know? So,
yeah.
So it does always, you know, we had that on Hangover 2 and with Bangkok. I mean, right. it was mayhem to film there. But again, I always feel like it's just bring something to the picture that's great.
Yeah. And you go back to Las Vegas as well, which is obviously
yeah.
you know, the home of
that's
the Hangover.
That's my place, yeah.
Yeah. Were you welcomed back with open arms? I mean,
oh, yeah. I mean, I think I could get a key to the city of Vegas if I wanted one. They are very warm to us and yeah. gracious, and they treat us like it's amazing, actually.
Yeah. Did you revisit Caesar's Palace? And
yeah, we stayed there, me oh, and nice. Bradley. We shot there on this movie a yeah. little bit. Yeah, we love that place. It's my second home.
You're known to cameo in your movies. I didn't spot you in this one. I'm very fond of the gangbang guy from
right.
old school.
His name's Barry.
Barry.
And he shows up every so often in certain movies. He's yeah. in Old School. He's in Road Trip. He's in Old School. He's in Hangover 1 and Hangover 3. He's in Due Date.
Yeah.
But he's not in every movie. And right. he has a very particular set of rules and what he will and won't do.
Yeah.
So it turns out he refuses to work with Jonah Hill. But
oh, right. Well, that's good to know. We hope to see him again sometime.
Thank you. I'll yeah. let him know.
I should ask about Old School. For a lot of people, that is a, you know, a classic comedy.
Thank you.
And it's sort of the first time for a lot of people, at least over here, that we saw Will Ferrell in a big role.
Yeah.
What's your memory of the streaking scene, especially seeing him on stage with Snoop Dogg?
I know. My memory of it, I haven't thought about it in a long time, but my memory of it when you just started talking about it was how down for anything Will Ferrell was yeah. and continues to be. I mean, he is a magical actor because he's just up for anything for the laugh. And, you know, there's real vulnerability standing naked in front of 300 extras on stage with Snoop Dogg that most actors would go, I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah.
But Will was just up for anything. And to me, that is the number one ingredient for a comic actor. It's just like, okay, let's try it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just remember that about that movie. All those guys, they were just down to fuck around and try right. and make something really funny.
Did he wear a modesty pouch when
he... You know, it's funny. He did at first yeah. and it kept getting in the way and we just ended up losing it and he was just naked and he didn't give a shit.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
That's impressive commitment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the best.
You went on to cast Snoop Dogg in Skuskin Hutch.
That's right.
What the hell is it like to give directions to Snoop Dogg? Like,
it was different on Old School than Starsky and Hutch. And I remember saying to him, because on Old School it was more difficult. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's going to be hard on Starsky and Hutch. And he had said to me, you know, I want to play Huggy Bear in Starsky and Hutch. And I go, I go, Snoop, I go, I don't know if I can do it because, like, this was really hard these 2 days filming with you. And, you know, on a movie, you're going to be in this movie for 15 days and you got to be there at 7 a.m. and you got to be there all day. And he very wisely said, no, no, no. He goes, on Old School, you hired Snoop Dogg to be in your movie. He goes, in Starsky and Hutch, you're going to hire Calvin, the actor, to play Huggy Bear. He goes, that's a very different thing. Okay. And I trusted him, and he was unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, he's perfect for the role. It's written for him.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy.
Is he, as I imagine him to be, there's smoke clouds coming from his trailer every morning?
There really is, yeah. He makes no apologies about and doesn't try to hide the fact that he is does get high all day every day.
Yeah.
But he manages to, you know, he always remembered all his lines. Okay. And yeah, I mean, he's amazing.
Okay.
I love him.
Also, what is it like to give directions to someone like Mike Tyson? I mean, he does not strike me as a natural actor.
No, he's not, you know, but and on Hangover 1 in particular, he wasn't. But the more comfortable he got, the easier it got. But you're right. It was difficult at first. But now, I mean, I'm really close with him now, weirdly to say. And I love the guy. And he's, I mean, to me, he made The Hangover. Yeah. To me, he's such a key part of The Hangover.
Yeah.
We were so lucky to get him. But it was intimidating at first, to answer your question. You know, you're giving direction to you know, the heavyweight champion of the world, one of the most feared people on planet Earth. And I remember in particular telling him one day, I've told this story before about, you know, he had to punch Zach Galifianakis in the face.
Right.
And he wasn't throwing the punch correctly for movies. You know, there's a particular way where the camera is. And in a weird way, he was almost too afraid to come close to Zach, but he needed to come closer. So I was trying to show him how to throw a punch, and he literally goes, oh man, this is great. I'm getting boxing lessons from the captain of the Jewish debating team. And everybody laughed at me, and I sulked off to my corner. No, but it was really funny. And it was totally one of those surreal moments in your life where you're going, wait a minute, I am trying to show Mike Tyson how to throw a punch. Yeah. I've never thrown a punch in my life, by the way.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
We heard news the other day that you're making a TV show about ISIS with Bradley Cooper. Is there anything you can tell us about?
Well, that's that was a poorly timed announcement, quite frankly. Bradley and I have a little production company together. We made War Dogs through it, and we had optioned a book that won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction recently called Black Flags, and it's something that we set up at HBO. It's not for me to direct. It's just a project we're producing together.
Okay.
But we have no real movement on it, no announcement.
Early
stages.
Okay. So what is next for you then as a director? Do you have any plans?
You know, I don't know yet. I haven't figured it out. I have a couple things in mind, but I'm not sure. I got to get through this sort of anxious stage of putting a movie out, which is always really terrifying and hard, and then I'll sort of see.
Okay. And do you think you're going to stay in the sort of comedy drama vein, or are you going to move?
I don't know. You know, I love making comedies, meaning it's not like I'm trying to get away from the comedies that I've done in the past. I love making comedies, particularly I love working with the actors that do comedies.
Yeah.
So I could see doing a straight up comedy again.
Okay.
Thanks,
great.
Man.
Well, I hope we see Barry again.
All right. He might just do the Barry and Chow movie.
Exactly. That'd be perfect. Hey, Todd, thank you so much
for your time.
Thank
you.
Cheers.
Take care.
Thanks.
Okay. So first up in the review section, we just spoke to Todd Phillips. That's here about his movie, War Dogs. Jonathan.
Hello, Chris. Yeah, War Dogs. It stars Jonah Hill, and it also has Miles Teller in it. And Jonah Hill is a man who sees a gap in the market in about the mid-noughties. He sees a gap for buying or supplying the US Army with military equipment. And, you know, he's taking tiny, 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 tiny pieces, which the big companies don't want to take. But those pieces, because it's the US military, even the tiny pieces are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. So that's what he does. He ropes in Miles Teller, who's his friend from school, and they set up a partnership and start supplying guns and start supplying ammunition, and they make a lot of money, and it goes very well, and then, of course, it goes less well, and things all start to fall down around them.
Because they cut corners, and they're dealing with dodgy people.
I mean, really, in many... Yeah, exactly. In many ways, it's Jonah Hill's fault. He's the bad guy, and well, I mean,
it's more serious though, isn't it? It's not a comedy per se.
It's not a comedy. It's not a drama. It's both. I don't know if that's ever been done before, but yeah, it mixes like jokes and serious stuff. And, you know, I saw it quite a long time ago, but it's, you know, it stuck with me. I keep on thinking back to things. It's got a really fun guest role for Bradley Cooper as a seriously evil arms dealer dude. There's a great scene in it, or a great sequence in it, where they do a gun run into a very heavily militarized zone, have to get through it, and people are trying to kill them, and they have to deliver these guns, and it's actually a lot of fun. John Nugent reviewed it. He said in the review that it aims for Scorsese levels and falls somewhat short, but it's a high bar to hit, and, you know, he doesn't quite make it, but he doesn't come that far off. We gave it three in the magazine, but that's a recommendation.
It is indeed, because he's got a nice, there's a weirdly misanthropic streak that goes through all Todd Phillips movies, and this one similarly so.
I feel like it's rather been marketed as a comedy.
Yes.
But it's not a comedy.
I mean,
not just.
It's not just a comedy. And so I suppose, it's certainly not a comedy in the way that The Hangover is. It's a comedy in the way The Hangover 3 is.
It's a drama.
Yeah.
That was really weird. You know, if we had more time, we could talk about how The Hangover 3 just went off the rails and became a weird thriller. But three stars then for War Dogs. That is, of course, as we say on the podcast, a recommendation. Next up is Bad Moms.
Yes, apologies. I haven't written the review for this yet, but I will. So this is Mila Kunis as a suburban mother of two. She does say that she got pregnant early, which is why she looks like Mila Kunis. Anyway, she is obsessed with being sort of the perfect mother. She's, you know, looking after her kids. She's got a job. She's got a husband. She's always running late, trying to do everything. And then, you know, the one last straw from PTA president Christina Applegate basically breaks her back, and she just swears off all of it. She's like, I don't care anymore. I'm going drinking with Catherine Han and Kristen Bell, and you can't stop me. So it's kind of, there's a bit of drama under the comedy here, in that this deals with some really genuine, true problems with being a mother in the modern age and being a woman in the modern age, where you're trying to do absolutely everything at all times perfectly and you're judged if you don't. But at the same time, it's a big, glossy, silly Hollywood comedy that makes very little sense when you think about it. And it does have, you know, extremely rich, well-off people who end up, spoiler, happier than they went into it. So, you know, it's kind of limited in how much truth it can really serve up. But at the same time, it is pretty funny. Catherine Han's always great fun. Mila Kunis is actually very good once you get over the fact that, you know, she's not entirely maybe the perfect casting for the role. It's probably a three. There are some funny stuff in there.
Okay, so you haven't officially decided yet. It could be anything.
I haven't written the review is the problem.
I mean, the magazine's in newsagents now, Helen.
Well, I didn't see it. They didn't screen it, in
There's
fairness.
There's a big space in the magazine where this review should be. This big white space.
I was just going to say, this film doesn't seem to have been marketed at all.
Not particularly
obsessed
over here,
with marketing.
I know.
But that's weird, because it's made actually nearly $100 million in the US. So it's been actually a big success. But yeah, the distributor here hasn't done a lot with it, and certainly didn't screen it for critics. So we only just saw it. So we'll get on that.
It's weird if it's quite good.
You'd think that, though, wouldn't you? Think, immediately assume. I mean, I saw a poster for it last weekend. It's the first time I'd even heard of it. You'd assume that means it's bad, but it's not.
It's not
and
terrible.
There's presumably quite a big audience for this sort of film.
Yeah, there will be.
Yeah.
Potentially then three stars for Bad Moms. A comedy that might be better is Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, Phil Catt.
Yes. Tremendous.
Great.
Four stars.
Also out this week.
I love Lonely Island. I guess it helps if you like these guys. Two of whose names I can pronounce. The third I might get wrong, but I'm kind of a crack.
Andy Samberg.
Yeah, okay, fine. I got that one. Andy Samberg, Akira Schaffer. And
Akiva Schaffer.
Akiva, no, shoot. My percentages are way down. And Jorma Taccone.
It'll do.
Anyway, I like looking at them and laughing at them. I don't know how to say their names, apart from Andy Samberg. And he plays a kind of a Justin Bieber type character called Connor For Real, who has come out of a boy band, the Star Boys, who have an early Beastie Boys vibe to them with the two other Lonely Islanders. And he's gone on and he's broken out. And like Justin Timberlake, when he left NSYNC, whatever happens to the solo artist, right? Flounders. And that's the problem that he has. He basically finds that his first album, which is called Conquest, double C, double N, doesn't do very well. Gets a poo emoji from Rolling Stone magazine.
It's his second solo album, isn't it?
Second solo album. First solo album's done fine. Well pointed out, well spotted, Johnny. And
that's
then he goes on a
Thriller
world tour.
Again, right?
And it is a lot of big gigs, a lot of things going wrong for him slowly, a lot of great cameos, really just packed full of jokes. A penis, I don't know if prosthetic or otherwise, makes an incredible cameo, but there's also cameos from...
Belonging to a famous director.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I wonder which director who was famous was close to this film.
Terrence
A director
Malick.
Who has been on this podcast, but thankfully not in this chair.
Oh, well, this is maybe tune back next week for more information on Penis Gate. Great cameos, and it's just genuinely silly and funny for the majority of its runtime. I think like a lot of these kind of spoofy, you know, the Spinal Tap. Kind of vibe hangs over it. It's not quite on that level. The plot gets a bit plotty towards the beginning.
I hate when plots get plotty.
It gets so plotty towards the beginning of the final act, but it nails the ending, and it's got a great bit where Seal gets attacked by wolves. So if that's the kind of thing you're looking for this weekend, I can so heartily recommend
this. So if you love Hot Rod, if you love Lonely Island, this
put it
is
this
a
way,
film for you.
I saw it on Tuesday, and I'm going to go and see it again in the cinema this weekend.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Which I don't normally do.
Does it have subtitles?
Yes.
Okay, well, there you go.
He's going to the closed caption screening.
Four stars
in for Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, which may be the best title of the year as well. Next up is Julieta. We had Pedro Almodovar on the podcast last week. Phil, tell us about this.
Pedro Almodovar is back, and that's always cause for, you know, a certain degree of celebration. I think this is his 20th feature film.
Wow.
Across like 3 decades. And he's come a long way. This is, you know, his last film was a slightly sort of ill-executed return to the sort of frothier camper side of his game.
But what was that? I'm so excited.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This one is a much more sort of serious-minded film about motherhood, really. I guess it's the other film this week about mumhood, but a lot more kind of serious in its approach, based on Alice Munro's Runaway, 3 short stories from an anthology of short stories there. And it cleverly takes threads from those stories and weaves them together into two discrete timelines. So you have two actresses playing the same character, Emma Suarez and Adriana Ugarte, I think is how it's pronounced, across 2 different timelines. And the plot setup sees the younger Julieta embarking on a fateful train journey, which has sort of slightly Hitchcockian overtones, which reminded me a bit of The Skin I Live In, his sort of psycho thriller from a few years back. And she basically falls in love with a fisherman, and a tragedy unfolds. They have a child together, but there's a tragedy, and her daughter, Julieta's daughter, disappears. And so the film, across these sort of contemporary and flashback, shows her of trying to deal with this pain, this kind of unspoken pain. It's a movie about kind of an introspective grieving for someone that's missing but isn't dead. And it's moving, it's very heartfelt, and I think Almodovar is a very, very good chronicler of human emotion. He's a very empathetic filmmaker. He's a good listener, if that makes sense. And this is a film that we liked. We've given 4 stars to. It's probably not a great double bill with Popstar, I would say. But if you like his style and the way that it's evolved down the years, this is a kind of a return to All About My Mother, that kind of era of his filmmaking.
Awesome. I haven't seen this yet, and I'm dying to, because I love a bit of Almodovar.
I don't think you'll be disappointed.
I will.
He's
not.
Very kind of all the films are out this week, this is one of the most distinctive in its style, I think. He's got a very distinctive way, and even though he's made films, Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, Women on the Verge, those kind of films that are incredibly like frothy and flighty, you can always tell in Almodovar film whether he's serious or he's having fun. This is more on the serious end of things.
And Rossi De Palma's back in this one, which is kind of cool. She's one of his kind of muses.
Yeah, she is, and she plays this kind of Mrs. Danvers-like character. You know, Mrs. Danvers from Rebecca, the kind of the evil, sort of sinister janitor, caretaker type thing. And she's clearly having fun, and it's nice to see. She's a distinctive-looking presence in his films.
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice to have that kind of DNA there as well. So, yeah, fans of Almodovar, I think, will be really, really happy with this one.
So 4 stars then for Julieta, which is fantastic. Also out this week is The Purge: Election Year, which stars Frank Grillo. It's a sequel to The Purge, and The Purge Anarchy films I really like, weirdly, despite everything. And this stars Frank Grillo, and he's trying to stop assassination of a presidential candidate on Purge Night.
Ah!
3 stars for that one. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast, sponsored by American Airlines. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by... TBC.
Mystery guest.
Yeah.
Yeah, mystery guest is better than TBC.
Yes.
We don't know yet.
Well, we do. We do kind of know.
But we haven't got confirmation.
Do we know?
So. We're in talks with Blimey O'Reilly's people.
Yes. He's back.
Again.
He's back. Helen will be here.
Yes. Probably.
you know, further expounding on your hatred of gravity.
I like gravity.
You hate Sandra Bullock.
Until then.
You hate Sandra Bullock.
Until that glorious day. It's goodbye from Johnny.
Goodbye, mate.
It's goodbye from Philcat.
Arrivederci.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Adios.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get tickets for the hottest musical of 2005. Spamalot.
I want to push the Spamalot.
Until then, see you next week. Bye.